With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. And I'm particularly delighted. It's more than delighted. It's over the moon to say that we are joined by Jason Isaacs. Jason, where the hell are you?
I am in a particularly unwelcoming Toronto. It was waist or chest deep in snow yesterday. And we had a snow day at school. I got to work and half the crew and cast had not made it. They'd shut the streets down. So we've shot what we could with the people who were available.
And what are you shooting? Can you tell us?
I can. I'm never in anything secret. And
I mean, you're a total blabbermouth, but just, you know, I just
wonder because they never fire you. You sign those NDAs. What are they going to do? Sue you? You're in the thing.
Okay. Have you ever been actually reprimanded for telling a journalist something that you shouldn't have told them?
Yes, and for posting things as well. I don't.
Okay. It's fine. Was that on Star Trek?
Yes.
Of course it was
because
on Star Trek.
Because I learned on Harry Potter when they had don't take photographs. I didn't take photographs. Now I regret it enormously. And so on Star Trek, there were huge posters going, do not take photographs. And I just filmed from the second I got there to when I left. I have a million pictures. But no. So I'm filming a television series, which is already on television in America and Canada and places, called Good Sam. It's a medical drama, and I find myself elbow deep in blood most of the time and other people's organs.
Excellent.
And I'm doing my very best Holby City impression.
And how are you doing with that? Because I have a whole thing. I'm terrified of, I mean, I can watch dramas and horror for the rest of it, but I'm actually really scared of actual blood. My whole family was medical. So I'm terrified of hospitals. I'm terrified of doctors. I'm terrified of actual things.
I'm rubbish. In real life, I'm absolutely rubbish. People could just describe to me something that's happened to them. Obviously, if it's in the downstairs department, I'm wincing already. But even wherever it is, anywhere, I find it stomach churning. But when it's prosthetics, I'm remarkably brave and heroic. Yesterday, I had my hands around a heart. I was bypassing and
when,
doing okay, all kinds
but when,
of things.
When you have your hands around a heart in a drama, we will get to the meat of this later on. But when you have your hands around a heart, do they use like animal hearts or is it prosthetic heart? How does it work? I mean, so many times you see
We're shooting right next to a funeral director, so they're freshly deceased people who've given their organs to art, and they're cadavers. Oh, it's rubber, for God's sake. It's all rubber.
Thank you.
What do you think? I mean, by the way, they're extraordinary. They pump, and the blood works, and the veins snap off, and it all looks magnificent, but the blood tastes of maple syrup.
What's the worst injury or medical moment you have ever had?
In my real life or on
your
screen?
Your real life. I'll tell you mine, but you go first and I'll tell you mine.
Well, I don't know. I'm thinking about the first time I remember hurting myself at all was when my best friend, Katie, gave me some Vicks Vapor Rub when I had a bad chest when you and I were at school together when I was 12. Yeah. And I rubbed it on my chest, lying in my bed at night where I sleep naked. And then I stroked myself the way one does, gently, for comfort and the testicles. And I leapt out of bed, screamed, probably for my mother. I hope not, in retrospect, that I didn't, and needed to wash the nether regions for quite a while before the stinging went away. That's the first pain I remember. There'd been many things since then, but that stays with me.
Well,
what have you got for me?
Well, that massively trumps mine. But no, so mine is one of the
I'm
reasons.
I'm eating, by the way. Are we broadcasting pictures? Because I'm eating.
If it's a Patreon person, you know, on Patreon,
good.
We have the video.
Enjoy,
so
everyone.
What are you
Excellent.
Eating there,
everyone
Jason?
Enjoy. I'm eating. Well, I couldn't get food delivered yesterday, and we worked like these 16-hour days, crazy days. But no one could deliver because no one could open their front door. So I made a stew of all the rotting vegetables at the bottom of my fridge.
Yum.
And scraped the mold off. I thought if I boiled it hot enough, surely it kills every germ. And it's that.
And how is it? Is it tasty?
Hmm. Problem is,
it looks horrid.
Problem is, I've not used a microwave in this house before. I think, it's industrial. And that's just melted a hole through my tongue. But... It's tasty if you like heat.
While your
you were saying.
Well, no, I was going to tell you, while your tongue recovers, I'll tell you my much less exciting thing. Before we were at school together, when I was at primary school, one of the reasons I, you know, when you do your roles, you grow beards and things and facial hair and all that. I can't. I can't grow a beard because I've got these all these bald patches. And the reason is that when I was a kid, we used to live in Brooklyn Rise in Hampstead. And my mum had a little Morris Minor. And we were in the Morris Minor. She pulled out the thing. And I was in the front seat. Back then, kids were in front seats and nobody thought it was a bad idea.
With no seatbelt on.
No seatbelt, exactly. Yeah. You know, with holding glass.
Smoking, probably. Yeah.
And mum was drinking, obviously. And mum said, is your door locked? And I said, yes. And to prove it, I leant on the door, which not only wasn't locked, wasn't shut. And I went straight out of the car and face planted on the thing. And I've got all these scars on my...
Scars.
Yeah. So I can't grow facial hair around those bits. So when I grow it, it looks like that thing out of Team America World Police when he has the facial hair grafted on. And it's a shame.
Because I've seen your face close up many a time.
Yeah, you can't see it. I mean, they're just like, they're white. Yeah. You know how scars are. They're white. This is the bit that you can see. Because one of the things that I did was I drove my tooth went through my tongue. And you probably can't see because I've got the film. But I got a big lump on my tongue where my bottom tooth came up through the thing.
That's that reminds me of time I was living in Venice Beach making something. I think it might be Armageddon time or something. And I used to go rollerblading down the front, that famous bit at the front, which is kind of a path for bike riders and rollerbladers.
Of course you did.
Of a morning. And I was rollerblading down there nice and early, most things closed, no tourists around. There was a guy leaning in front of the tattoo shop. And from behind him were coming these absolute blood-curdling screams. Literally someone going, and I looked at him and very casually, I think he was smoking a joint. He nodded his head backwards and went, tongue. That's all he said. Just that one word. I don't know what they were doing to the tongue, but nothing good.
You don't have any tattoos, do you?
Oh, God, no. I can't decide what to order off a menu, let alone some pattern I want to live with the rest of my life. No, but I'll tell you where my life is. God, it's so nice to see you. I probably shouldn't record any of this. It's just old friends. But when I was going to lots of conventions before the pandemic came along, which I kind of rather love meeting people and talking about films and stuff, and particularly seeing how much Harry Potter meant to so many people. So people would come up and they really wanted to, you know, share what it had meant to them. And then every now and again, some lovely young person will ask me to sign their body to have it tattooed on there because they have tattoo artists at the conventions. And I beg them not to. I always beg, please don't. And they very often then open their shirt and show they've got the rest of the cast or every Star Trek. And I just, it's so upsetting that someone will have just an idiot like me, you know, scarred on the body forever. And I've been searching for ways to persuade people not to do it. And the last time it happened, this young woman came up. And she said, will you sign my arm? And I said, oh, don't do that. Look, you can have as many pictures as you like for free. And she went, I want your signature. And I said, what if I turn out to be a paedophile? I don't know where it came from. And she went, what? I said, what if it turns out I've got this sordid past and you've got my name wrong? And she went, well, are you? Were you? And I go, I don't know. People blank things out. Maybe they'll come to light under hypnosis. And she went, any pictures? And I went, as many as you like. And so from then on, that was my tactic. People come up and I go, maybe I've got some really dark secrets in my past. And that's it.
But it's also, I mean, you and I went to school with somebody who ended up being a kind of in a punk band that were quite big for a while. And they toured with, this is Kevin, they toured with Adam and the Ants. They toured with Adam and the Ants. And if memory serves, he had an Adam and the Ants tattoo at the point when Adam and the Ants were really sort of like a rocking, you know, punk band. 5 years later, they're opening the Royal Variety performance, you know, and bowing in front of the Queen. And it's always the thing about never have any pop star tattooed on your body. You have no idea where their career is.
Never have anybody's name. Nothing. This is a story that he tells, so I'm not telling indiscretion or else I would never do it. But Alan Cumming is an old friend of mine. And at one point he came to London and saw his old friends and had dinner and stood up with his new boyfriend. He said, "Let's show them now, shall we?" And everybody, and they opened their pants and they dropped their pants because they had their undies on. And he said, "This is my new boyfriend, Raven. And Raven and I have had tattoos on of each other's names." And they'd had each other's names tattooed across their groin. And we all slack-jawed, just stared in silence, thinking, "You've been going out for 5 months. What are you doing?" And sure enough, years later, it's part of Alan's one-man show. He tells a story about how many years and how much pain it's been to have that removed. He's very happily married to a wonderful man. But yeah. I can't decide on it. I would have a tattoo if I knew there was some pattern I'd like to see the rest of my life. But yeah. I don't want to see myself.
I had a tattoo when I was young, and then I had it taken off because it was like, it was a stupid... I mean, of course, obviously, when they take tattoos of you, still have a scar. So it's like, rather than having the tattoo, you've got a scar in the shape of the tattoo, which you wish you hadn't done.
What was your tattoo?
You see if you can tell from the shape of the scar. Hang on.
Great radio. I will describe for you, ladies and gentlemen. I can see...
Barely, you can see it there.
A patch of arm.
Hang on, I'll shine a torchlight on
it. It looks ruddy.
Yeah, hold on. Oh, you can't see. Hold on.
No, is it possible to see?
You can't see. Well, there.
Yeah, but no. It's...
It was a bird. It was a bird.
A bird? Yeah. That's not offensive.
No, it's not offensive.
It was just a phoenix.
Didn't like it. No, that's right, yes. No, it was just like one of those things that I did when I was young and stupid, and then I grew up and thought, oh, for heaven's sake. And it wasn't very
good.
Just
to pass the time in Borstal, presumably.
That's right, exactly. That was the other thing, is it wasn't very good. I think if it had been good. I got it done in the Arndale Centre in Manchester, and I have to say, it was a lunchtime. I was, it was a lunchtime. Oh, I've got half an hour free. I think I'll get my body permanently scarred.
Yeah, no, it's a terrific idea. When you were drunk in the Navy. No, I would, by the way, I do love a great tattoo. And I also admire and I'm slightly in awe of people's certainty that it's something that they want to look at for the rest of their life. But I'm living in a rented house. I'm talking to you from Toronto, a rented house. I quite like being in rented accommodation on my way working because I don't have to look around and go, I chose that table. I'm not sure about that art. I don't, because it's not mine. None of it's mine. And I don't have to judge myself by it. It's the reason I wear the same T-shirt and jeans every day. I go, they're not me. They're just the things I put on.
So on the subject of
meanwhile, back at the farm.
Yeah. So Jason, I have been going on about Mass. Well, it must be a year now because I think I first saw it a year ago because it played at Sundance. Mm-hmm. And I said it then and I'll say it again now. I think it's absolutely astonishing. I think it's not just the best work that you've ever done, but I think it's like a really important film. For people who don't know about it, because it's opening now in the UK, so it's going to be in some cinemas and it's going to be on Sky Cinema. Just tell us what Mass is about, and then we'll discuss the kind of intricacies of it. Sure. But I just want to restate that I think it is a really brilliant piece of work and really powerful. And I've seen it a couple of times now, and you know that I've been going on about this like ever.
No, you've been a fantastic advocate for it, and I'm. I find it slightly embarrassing that I am too, because I'm in it. So it's, and obviously you and I have spoken professionally over the years and I'm publicizing other things and some of them are good, very good, and some of them aren't. And every now and again, something comes along, which is so much bigger or more important. These are words that make something sound worthy. It's incredibly watchable than the ego of any of the participants. This is on the baseline, it does that thing that film should do. It, like, you want to watch it. You want to find out what's going to happen next. It's got intrigue, a mystery, got a story. Four people walk into a room. What's going to happen? But it also, and it does that other thing, that film should do, which is it finishes. You think, oh, God, I'd like to watch another film soon. Films are amazing, aren't they?
Yeah.
But it takes the audience. I've now seen it with lots of audiences on a huge emotional journey. Through all kinds of experiences and leaves you, I think, without too much of a spoiler, spiritually uplifted. I mean, believing in possibility, believing in hope, believing maybe in the power, the essential, almost divine nature of forgiveness. I mean, for everyone who is used to, as we all are, watching films going, well, that was well done. Well, that was interesting. That was kind of intriguing for a while. Then should we have Chinese? Should we have a curry? Or, you want a pizza? Like, this is a big experience. It grips you. It grips you with its specifics, but it also has something incredibly resonant and universal to impart. Not because it's a message film, because nothing clear comes out of it. There aren't any answers or anything. But in the end, it's a, to my mind, and I'm so wary and aware, you know, I'm glad we'll go into detail. This sounds so incredibly pretentious, but it's a plea for human contact. It's a plea for connection. And for us in these increasingly divided times, so where, I mean, it was divided times before the pandemic. Now we're divided and isolated. And we're in times when those divisions have been weaponized by people like Trump and other people that, you know, we're turned against each other by social media and by the echo chambers we live in. It's a plea for engaging with each other as human beings and to see each other and to hear each other and ultimately to free ourselves from resentment and blame and all those toxic forces that actually can ruin our lives without changing anything outside ourselves. So anyway, that's a long-winded way of saying, I think I agree with you. I think it's a really, really special and piece of work and a huge experience and a great movie, which is ironic for a film which is mostly about four people sitting in a room. Yeah. And we can talk about what the plot is, but the plot, you know, it's really not about a shock. Like, this is really not about the incident that set these four people up that they examine, because they're looking for answers, but it's as much about marriage, about denial, about hope. It was inspired, the writer-director Fran Kranz, who is more articulate, obviously, than I am about it, but it was inspired enormously by the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission amnesty hearings and by Desmond Tutu's book, you know, that if those people, the people who went through that, can find it in their heart to forgive for themselves as much as for the other people. And if the characters in this film who are, have experienced something so extreme, I hope to God that nobody ever listening has to go through, if they can find it in their heart and recognize the necessity of forgiveness, then any of us can. And so that's what the film's about. It's a very long answer, but I do think it's about all those things.
When you talk about blame on your part, I want to know what you're referring to.
There is nothing that wasn't covered in the depositions.
But I want to hear it now. We never filed against you. We never took part in any of that.
Maybe a better way than interrogating is to learn what we remember.
Fine. So, tell me what you remember. Tell me about your son.
What would you like to know?
Everything. I want to know everything.
Why?
Why do I want to know about your son? Because he killed mine.
But it's interesting. You say, you know, it's not about the four people in the room. What's going to happen? The question also is, what has happened? And one of the things about the film is two couples, four people, they meet in a room in a church. So the name Mass obviously alludes to this, you know, to something larger than just
spiritual, if not religious. Certainly.
Exactly. Yeah. But crucially, they're in a room that is off from the church. So they're not in the church. They're in a church room, which I think is a really, it's a brilliantly liminal space. It's somewhere between the two worlds. And what they are there to do is to attempt to discuss a trauma that they all share from different sides. And they all come to it with a certain degree of, you know, baggage and PTSD and a whole bunch of other things.
Sure.
And then what happens over the course of the drama is that we slowly start to figure out what the thing is that's happened. Although it's not a great,
revelation. I think the mystery as much, sorry to interrupt you, they don't come to discuss it. There's a very specific mandate. The whole film, I mean, apart from the setup, starts where I pull over to the side of the road and my wife goes, I don't think I can do it.
Yeah, yeah.
She's got a mandate. She has come there to do something.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that we've been told that will help. We've come there because our life is ruined, not because our life was ruined 6 years ago by the school shooting. It's because our lives are unbearable at the moment. It's not the incident that lives with us. It's our daily lives, our daily compromises, our inability to see, talk to each other, to be parents, to be in the world. And we just need to break, something needs to break this paralysis. And so it's not, they don't come together to discuss it, to relive it. They've come because we've asked, myself, my wife, have asked them to turn up so that we can do this particular thing. And in some ways, that's the mystery. What is the particular thing they've come to do? And will it work? You know,
and that sense of the particular thing that they are trying to do is, you relate this back to the idea of forgiveness. What they are trying to do is to move on by somehow making peace with this thing. And and that's the central, it's like, is everybody just going to hit a brick wall, or are they actually going to be able to make, so are they actually going to be able to connect with each other and understand each other's point of view? And during the course of the drama, which kind of ebbs and flows, here's the weirdest thing, and this is a pain in the ass as a film critic. If you try and describe Mass, you do what you just did. You say it's four people in a room talking, which literally sounds like the cinematic kiss of death. You
know, what people say is it's four people who meet to relive a trauma. It's a harrowing account, and you go, who wants to see that? Even at the best of times, the happiest of times, it isn't. It's an uplifting to me. It doesn't mean to uplift it while you're watching it. It's uplifting like when you go on a roller coaster, you know, it's terrifying to go down the hill. And this is very emotional, but you don't want to spoil it, because our plot is what the characters feel and say and what happens to them. So if you give away that, you're giving away, we don't have Jeff Goldblum uploading a code to the aliens. Like we've just got what they do and what they feel. But without spoiling it too much, it will take you to a place, hopefully, of, it's almost religious, and I'm not religious at all, a place of belief and hope in the capacity of humankind to overcome.
Tell me about working with those other three key cast members. I mean, I know this is a thing, you know, the cast really bonded during the making of a film, which is the kind of the standard cliche. It's the thing, you know. What was it like working with Bruce? Well, he was
great.
It's
very hard to avoid the cliches. Which have been so denuded by being used in other contexts, because they really work in this one. You know, I didn't know them. In fact, let me rewind slightly earlier. When I was offered the job, I asked to get involved, I remember reading it. And, you know, you and I are both quite lachrymose, but, you know, this one just got me. I was sitting in Starbucks, just sobbing. And at the end, feeling like I wanted to run and kiss everyone and phone everyone I love, and snot pouring down me, waiting for them to have called the funny farm. Just waiting for,
that's just you on a Friday, isn't it? That's usual.
Yeah, they've given me a very wide berth. and then I went to meet this young actor who'd written it, thinking, is he going to make this? Is it ever going to happen? And if he did, is there any chance that any actors on the planet could convey what just happened to me when I read it? Sometimes things read well and they're just unactable. And then I thought, as it was clear he was going to try and make it as a film, he didn't have the money, you know, even though it wasn't going to be much money, it was some money. And I thought, I don't think I'm up to it. I mean, this requires something of the actors that you don't see normally, a kind of rawness and honesty and authenticity to leave any of the tricks at the door and just be open to whatever comes and feels. You can't plan it. Am I good enough? And then last of all, is anybody going to watch this? Like, even if we had all that stuff, would it be one of those times when actors really said, oh my God, we climbed an emotional Everest, and then you watch it and you go, ugh, a bunch of people shouting at each other in a room. You know, like, it would any of it begin to convey through a screen when, as you say, it's four people talking? And I knew that I wanted to do it because I thought, well, I'm glad that I'm scared of it. Yeah. Now that I'm scared of seeing if I could do it or not. It's nice to be scared. And if it fails, four of us will fail. Or maybe I'll be terrible and they'll all be great, but whatever, you know. And I can't control if the thing is any good or not. But it depended enormously on us all, you know, those things that actors do, trust games and stuff, you know. And you really needed to know that you were safe in these other actors' hands to be vulnerable and to, you know, we were not being asked to do the kinds of normal things. It's a bit like a dance or something. I can't find a comfortable analogy, but you really, let me come at it another way. We met in New York for 2 days. Martha Plimpton plays my wife, wanted a rehearsal period of at least a week. Yeah. And I couldn't do it. I was making a film in Australia. And I said, I couldn't do it. And I couldn't do any. I had to go to Australia. And it looked like I wasn't going to be able to be in the film. And at that point, I felt very upset because I thought, well, it's going to be a big experience and I'll feel stupid missing out on it. And so I conceded 2 days and I completely changed my route. As I said, it's not a big budget film. So I flew to New York instead. For 2 days, we met in a room and I thought we were going to rehearse or do something. And Anne Dowd, who's a remarkable woman, yeah. not just as an actress, but as a woman, sagely, consciously or unconsciously, she knew that whatever this pretentious bonding crap that actors do is, it had to happen to the power of 10 in this film. And she just opened the discussion by telling us what was going on in her life. And it was something very vulnerable. We didn't know each other. And she told us something about her life, a vaguely parallel to us part of the story, but not really. And it opened the doors to us all peeling our layers back and showing each other who we were. And it was a bit like being in group therapy, where we're just ostensibly finding things that were in common with the story, but they weren't really. We were saying to each other, okay, you can really know me. I will let you know me more than my friends, maybe more than my family know me, and I've just met you. And for 2 days, we kind of made ourselves, I don't know, these phrases are so awful, but you know, like vulnerable, naked to each other, something. And we didn't get through the script. There was one moment where Fran said, look, we've got to do something with the script. Read it. Just tell me, is there anything you're not comfortable with, that you don't like? And you know the characters as well as I do by now, which was a very generous thing to say because it just wasn't true. Mm. And we all made some suggestions. I made some suggestions particularly. I remember thinking, Jay is going to this room because he knows what his wife needs to say. He likes a system. The therapist has told his wife what to do and say. He needs this other couple to say the things that allow her to say them, and then things will be fixed. And then he can go back to fixing the world because he thinks he can fix gun laws and psychiatric definitions. It's all to do with fixing problems outside himself. And so when Fran said to me, what do you think? Have you got any contributions? And I went, yeah, when they start blathering on about their experience there, I don't give a monkey's what they went through, these people. They need to say the stuff that my wife needs to hear. And that's, and similarly, everyone made some contribution. But we left after 2 days and we hadn't really addressed the script at all. And I went away to make a film. And 3 weeks or a month later, we met in Idaho and we've just hit the ground running and made the film. But that 2 days had been essential. I left and I thought, Christ, three strangers, and they just told me things about themselves and what they're feeling and what they're like. And and it worked. You know, you're used to that shorthand as an actor. We try and get to know someone intimately, but it worked. And we got there, and most of what I had to do, I felt, you correctly nailed it on the head, as you always do. You know, it really, a lot of what goes on in the room, or most of it, is about what's going on outside the room. You know, beforehand and in their life. And so Martha and I had to talk about what was our life. You know, did we sleep together anymore? When did we separate bedrooms? When did she start drinking? And I argued about it. You know, how often do I spend away in Washington lobbying? What do we say to our daughter? Do we still have pictures of our son up? Do I get annoyed when she talks about him? You know, do we never mention him? And then particularly, specifically, what are the things that we're meant to do in this room? And what I've been told we're not meant to do. What are the arguments? I don't know if you and Linda do this, but Emma and I definitely do. Like sometimes we'll be out in company and I'll bring something up and it seems innocuous, but what I'm really looking for is validation for an argument that we had privately at home, you know? Or I'll say to Emma, I'll say to my missus, I'll say, you know, well, look, you said this, you promised this about some situation. She'll go, I absolutely did not say that.
Yeah.
I don't know how you remember that. And so Martha and I would argue about what Jay and Gail had established between themselves. And she'd go, there's no way. And instead of nailing it down, we left it like that because we knew we were half arguing in character. Yeah. So we did a lot of time. We spent 2 weeks. It was really like going to some kind of intense rehab. We spent 2 weeks only half ever being ourselves and always somehow in the elevated, extreme emotional states of our characters. So we laughed. We laughed like drains all the time because we cried and we shouted. And by the way, in the evenings when we were looking at the next day's work, we would storm out and slam the door. And like, I mean, there was a lot of, we stayed in a heightened state and just hoped that if we were truthful in the room, some of it would be captured on the camera.
When he was 13, he started going online. He started that gaming profile, that account.
They weren't violent games then.
Yeah, I know that, but...
They were fantasy games, like role play.
Yeah, I know that, but it was still the same account that he used later on, so... I'm just asking what changed.
That's very hard to answer.
Well, please try.
It's not just one thing.
Then tell me more than one thing.
Hey, Gail, let's not do it like this, okay?
Okay. You're right. I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not interrogating.
Then what are you doing? I say that as compassionately as I can. What are we doing? You say you want to heal. We all do. Is this how?
Was there any of doing it that took you back to doing Angels in America?
Not really, only because a play is shared with the audience. You know, there's a difference. Some people, I think, mistakenly have talked about this as a play, and maybe it will be one day, but the camera can see what you're not saying. You're not saying it. I'm saying some people have said that, but when I think about that, when I've been asked it by journalists in the past, I go, well, I really think this is a film because it's, you know, they're sitting down. You'd have to move around if you're doing a play, but also there's 100 layers of hidden secrets and denial that the camera can see. That you can't. Angels in America, you're always aware of what you're sharing with the audience. And here, when I think back to the experience of making this film, I don't remember the cameras. I don't even remember Fran, the director. He very consciously and wisely stayed out of the room. He never put the camera between us, so we could always look at each other. It was always over someone's shoulders, you know. And so it didn't take me back to that. I do think what it's got in common is, you know, that felt too like serving a story which was bigger and better and more important than any of the actors. Yeah, I mean, two or three times in my life, I've been part of something and I go, this is fantastic. I almost wish I wasn't in it so I could make other people watch it. And Angels was like that. And Mass, I do think, look, you and I both love indie films and they're withering on the vine. It's very, very difficult to get people to buy a ticket. And, you know, I'm on the jury of various different awards organizations. And I see these films, they're made out of such great intent to address sexual abuse or the refugee problem or whatever. And they're very often worthy and they're boring. Like, you know, you can make a film about serious subjects and you and I might even find the time to like them and say they're well made. This is, to me, you know, I'm inside the bubble, which is why it's so great to hear someone whose opinion I respect like it too. I find this electrifying and compelling.
Yeah.
And yet it's about something, maybe one of the biggest subjects human beings can deal with, which is, you know, grace and generosity.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So if I can strike a slightly negative note.
Yeah, anything. Go.
Okay. One of the things that surprises me, and I mean, I'm sure there's reason, but I said, when I saw it, I said, you're going to get an Oscar nomination for this. I mean, I know it wasn't just blowing smoke up your ass. I said, you know, and you said, no, that's not how it works. And I said, what do you mean? You said, Oscar nominations aren't, I know this anyway. You said, they're to do with having the budget to campaign for things. We don't have the budget to campaign for things.
Yeah.
Part of me is just baffled that the film has flown under the awards radar, because I can't imagine anyone seeing it and not going, wow, that's really,
That's very nice of you to say, but it is true that the people who see it do. So lots of critics associations around the world have given it awards. It's won a lot of awards, a lot of ensemble acting awards, a lot of first screenplay awards, a lot of awards for Fran. But I know lots of people in the Academy, I know, you know, a bunch of Hollywood people, they haven't heard of it. They don't know it exists. They haven't watched it on the portal, the screening portal. People who watch it do think that. But mostly when you're given a choice of hundreds of films to watch, you watch the films that have got Golden Globe nominations, or you see an advert for every time you switch on YouTube, and they're watching Power of the Dog and Belfast and various other things. And do I think it's worthy of it? Yeah, I think it's as powerful a story as I've ever seen anywhere. But I was right, unfortunately. You know, it was a little bit frustrating because every critic said that, because you're right, people who watch it say that. And all of us have been nominated for and won San Diego Awards or New York Area Awards, or whatever. But the really giant ones, it just didn't get, doesn't, it's a very small film on a small budget from a fantastically committed smaller distribution company. And the awards world is a separate world from a kind of artistic meritocracy. Not that anything should ever win awards, that any piece of art is better than any other. But I did think that that might happen because you said it and other people said it. And then I just was proved right that I do really understand the way the business works.
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's not on
the BAFTA long list, for instance, which surprised me. But then I asked my friends, lots of them haven't watched it.
You see, this is
if
the
you
thing.
Haven't
that,
watched it, you don't
this
know
is the,
it.
This is the thing. If I think if film critics have any point in the world, and I think incidentally that's a big if, I think it's to alert people to things that they might have missed otherwise. And I will happily fly the flag for Mass because I think it is, it's one of the best films I've seen recently, and I know how many people haven't seen it. And I kind of feel like if I go door to door telling everybody that more people will see it and they will tell their friends and they will
tell
their friends.
Listen, it does count. And by the way, in some ways I feel like it's just not a good thing. I'd love for the film to have been nominated for or won those giant awards because it means a lot of people would see it. But it's true also that along the way, as part of that campaign, my ego got slightly involved. And I recognize that's unhealthy. I don't like that sense in myself that you're in that race and too many people tell you things that turn your head. And then you start to go, oh, I wonder, and the nominations are out tomorrow. And in some way, I feel the relief now that I can concentrate back on what really matters, which is, can I get lots of people to watch this story? Because I chose to go into the storytelling business because I believe in it. I think it's got the power to change. It changed me, and I think it's got the power to change other people. So the most important thing now that it's not going to get attention that way is to get attention other ways, like thankfully being on your podcast or on your radio show. And I've been up all day since 6 this morning, you know, banging the drum for it. And if I can get people to see it, it will make my ego right size again. I'm in the storytelling business. I love stories. I'm not in the aren't I wonderful business, you know.
Well, here's the weird thing. So if I completely coincidentally have this. Okay, so this has just come out. This is a Blu-ray of Shawshank. I got sent this because I made a documentary about Shawshank, which is on this. The funny thing about Shawshank is this: when Shawshank first came out, I didn't really get it. Didn't really get the thing. I ended up writing a book about it and making a documentary about it. And it was the book and the documentary were both entirely about how Shawshank became Shawshank. And Shawshank Redemption, I mean, it's a different thing. It's a fairly comparatively big budget movie, stars, you know, awards coverage. In the cinema, comparatively, nobody went to see
it. It tanked on the day. Didn't
it? It flopped. It flopped massively when it opened. Right. It took less than it cost. So it was a failure. And then it found its audience, weirdly, when the first home video went out. They shipped huge, and I ended up, I'm literally speaking to people in the industry, getting figures on this. They shipped huge numbers of video because what happened was that the people that went to see it all told their friends. And by the time their friends, then it was out. And then it went from being an actual failure, a box office flop, to being what is now regularly considered to be either 1, 2, or 3 in people's favourite movies of all time.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the really fascinating thing about it is it's one of the very few cases in which word of mouth, you can trace it. You can literally trace it, okay? That's how it happened. Shawshank happened because people said to each other, I saw this movie and I loved this movie and I think this movie will be important to you. And it's, you know, everyone, I remember Tim Robbins saying, people were saying to me, what was that thing you did, the shit shank reduction or something? They didn't even know the title of it. And I am completely, I have yet to meet someone who's seen Mass who has not been knocked out by it. And that's the thing that makes me think it's literally just a numbers game. You just need to get people to tell other people.
There's something else actually that goes on with Mass. And so I hope I didn't tread on any toes here. There was a big discussion about the title for a start. There was some notion of changing the title at some point.
I think it's a great title.
I always felt there should be a log line somewhere, but I could never think of one. So maybe that's the reason there wasn't, to make sure that people didn't think what they were doing was diving into a giant cauldron of pain. Because I think that in the end, and when people say to me, I watched it, but God, it was so harrowing, so emotional. And I think, well, are they going to recommend it to other people? You should see it. It's really upsetting. It's not. Like, I've seen it with audiences. People are slightly delirious. They're elated at the end. Yeah. There's the moment when the choir play and I, you know, when there is hope in the world, hope for these people, hope that their lives will be better, is divine. It's special. And I think that when people are recommending it to each other, what they're recommending is go, you'll be really upset, you'll get through two boxes of Kleenex. But they often forget to say, which is why I thought a tagline should help focus the press or even the text. You know, it was on the BAFTA portal and the Academy portal, and the text was part of the original copy that was written, which is two couples meet after a tragic incident to process their pain or something like that. I think, well, I wouldn't watch that. Who the hell would watch that? Oh my God. In a search for forgiveness, you know, or something. Or healing, some positive words. So I think, I hope you're right. I think it's a magnificent piece of work and great work in the end. I've been in a few things, oddly, that they're not like this, but over time, that were terrible failures that, you know, Peter Pan, for instance, was a catastrophic flop and it's now lots of family favourites. Even Event Horizon to an extent is a
culture. Well, I've always been a flag fly for Event Horizon. I think that's, you know, and I think what's hilarious about Event Horizon is how much now it's become the Uber text that everyone in the know refers. You know, oh, yeah,
yes, this yeah, yeah. Draws it's the template.
It really is. Yeah. That thing about log line, I mean, of course, in the case of Shawshank, the log line was brilliant. It was hope can set you free. And you go, because as
oh
you know...
Oh, my God, we should have nicked it. That's what we should have done.
Because as you know, we have said, there's a lot of Shawshank before the redemption, and yet somehow they managed to, you know, that whole idea about, you know, the picture of Tim Robbins. But yes, it is that hope can set you free It's hard to sell a movie to somebody in which the movie deals with stuff when it put, you know, it gets you in the feels. It gets its fingers into stuff which
but
is
it gets
messy.
You in the feels in the right way. Look, I could watch things that make me sad. I didn't mean I could barely get through The Road, but Vigo is a friend of mine. I had to watch it. Like, I remember Emma reading Cormac McCarthy's The Road at night, and every night I'd sit next to her and I'd look over and she's absolutely keening, sobbing. And I go, "What are you reading?" She'd go, "This thing is the saddest thing I've ever read." And I go, "Put it down. don't read it then. Is it real?" Because no, it's not like reading Elie Wiesel's Night or something. You know, to be made up. I think not that everything should have a happy ending. You know, sometimes they're cautionary tales, but I don't know about, you know, like for instance, Don't Look Up, which I rather enjoyed. I thought
so did I, brilliantly
disguised and fooled people with its comedy bells and tassels and you know, cast, kind of ensemble cast, into watching something. So that when it finishes, you go, "Oh my God, what are we doing? What am I doing in my life?" You know, I thought that was a rather fabulous sleight of hand trick. But generally, I think you need to offer some hope, not happiness, but something. And I think Mass does it in spades. I think everybody does it well. So I hope people see it. I mean, you'll help. Yeah, you know, the fact that you've said that they could put it on posters and stuff. But in the end, I avoided Manchester by the Sea forever. I love Kenny Lonergan. I thought... that first film he made with
Pay It Forward. No,
with Laura Linney and Matthew Broderick and Mark Ruffalo.
Which is called...
Oh, we'll come back to it. I can't believe it.
Yeah.
I used to recommend it to everyone. Anyway, I thought it was magnificent.
You can't remember it,
when he made Manchester by the Sea, and I heard what it was about, but why would I want to watch that? I watch documentaries all the time. But I want to immerse myself in tragedy. I do work with the Red Cross. You know, there's real tragedy all around me in London. So why do I? And it took me years to watch it. And still, having watched it at the end, I went, "I."
And because what? Because people had told you that it was depressing and
it's
awful.
About grief and loss, and you know, this man who was in terrible pain and couldn't get through it. And like, so I hope that when people watch Mass, they don't say that, because it isn't. It's about the search for I don't know how to cram this in, but one of the things I thought about a lot when we made Mass and afterwards, I've been involved a little bit with restorative justice things, but there's one particular story I heard on a podcast, which was this man who had been in prison, been a model prisoner, come out and now is a model citizen, changing the world and communities around him. And he attributed this to the moment in court when he had gone to be sentenced. He'd broken into a house, an old couple there, and he'd killed the man in the house, and his wife came to court to make a witness statement. And he braced himself and she stood up. I can't get through this without crying, sorry. She said, I love you and I forgive you and I wish you nothing but greatness in life. And it made his life great. And that is why I wanted to make Mass. That's what I hope it's about. That's what it, you know, I can wake up in the morning and be just crippled with self-pity, self-centeredness, and or anger, righteous anger. You and I are angry about a lot of the same things politically, a lot of the same groups of people. And, you know, you sit in a room with someone who is utterly convinced of things, and you might never agree with them. The people in Mass might never agree about anything, but they acknowledge each other's humanity, and it's a start. It's why there was peace in Northern Ireland. I worked with this group called ALMEP, which is an umbrella group of grassroots organizations across the Middle East, Palestinians and Israelis, farmers, mothers, sportsmen, you know, who artists, who despair at the failure of the politicians to bring about any meaningful change. But the reason they do it, the reason the organization exists, the reason it's been well-funded by a lot of people is because that's what George Mitchell credited the Northern Ireland peace agreement with, that it started because grassroots organization made contact and saw each other as human. They didn't agree, they didn't necessarily forgive, but they connected. And that's what I think stories can do.
Bipolar disorder, depression, mania, ADHD, possible schizoaffective disorder.
None of that is psychopathy. You don't know what you're talking about.
If you take the medical records with the criminal report, which we now finally we have the full report, don't you have to weigh the evidence, the facts of what he did against your personal relationship, your history
those
with
things. It wasn't always those things.
We can trace how far back to when he started planning it. We can trace his footsteps, for Christ's sake.
I don't think the timeline definitively proves anything about his mental state.
How can you say
We're
that?
We're not denying what he did or who he became.
Well, I can't help but hear you blame a not abnormal childhood.
He was my son. I can't remove my feelings from our history or his records.
I'm not asking you to. I'm saying that what he did, his capacity for murder was probably potentially there a long time before anyone could have known.
You think you can attach one word to something in order to understand it, to make you feel safe? Well, I won't say it. I don't believe it. It's not simple. It's everything you cannot see.
That film title you're trying to remember is You Can Count on Me. Why?
Oh, thank God for that.
Yeah, I know. Thank you. Why did I think Pay It Forward? Why is that?
Because you're old and your mind is failing.
No, that is right. But does that happen to you?
Sorry.
No, I mean, I am. You're kidding me? Same age, you know. It's like
I only remember things in character. That's why. I was doing an interview today because I've done all day Mass interviews. Obviously, the film's coming out, and I had realized something that it's odd because, you know, God, you've been conducting interviews and I've been giving them for 35 years. I've surely nothing new to say about my life, which has been not very interesting, and I've mined and milked every instant everything I can. But I realized that my daughter is at college and just directed her first play and it opened last night. And I was hoping that she would get in touch. Yeah, it was great. And I was hoping she would get in touch and go, oh my God, Dad, and, you know, talk about some seminal moment or some pivotal moment. It was nothing. It was just play opened and it went all right. And, you know, the lighting cue went wrong or whatever. But I remember that for me, the first time I went to a rehearsal room, not that I realized at the time, in retrospect, I'd been so uncomfortable. I know that your recollection is that I was very confident, which I definitely was what I projected, wanted to project. But I'd been so uncomfortable in so many different groups throughout my life.
Yeah.
But at school, in the community I grew up in Edgware, and then going to university, being surrounded by all those kind of Sloan Rangers and, you know, in many places. When I used to skateboard, being one of the only white kids at the South Bank and stuff like that. You know, there's just lots of places I felt that I was very successfully faking that I belonged, but there was a whole inner monologue. And I went to a rehearsal room because I, you know, just for play, I got in. And the first time I ever felt comfortable being myself was when I was exploring being other people.
Because
I could have their thoughts in my head. Now it seems ironic. I'm sure a psychiatrist has a field day with it, but the arts community or the community of storytellers, which you and I are both in at different sides of it, we are about not, you know, who you are and where you've come from, where you're, it doesn't matter. You know, we're exploring the human condition. And it was odd to think that the first time I felt truly comfortable was when I went into a room where you were going to pretend to be someone else.
I have to say, on the subject of which that was a beautifully eloquent thing, but on the subject of exploring the human condition, I did an on stage the other day with MK3D at the South Bank, and Joanna Hogg was one of the guests, and we'd asked her to pick a guilty pleasure film, and she said, "I'm going to pick a whole genre," and she went for disaster movies. She loves disaster movies. You know, Joanna Hogg. This is like Joanna Hogg, the person.
I know, it's very unlikely.
Yeah, she loves musicals and disaster movies, right? You know, but so and anyway, so she said, "Yeah, I see. I love disaster movies." She said, "You have to tell me a great disaster movie to see." I said, "Have you seen Skyfire?" She went, "No, what is it?" I said, "Jason Isaacs builds a hotel on the side of a volcano."
I loved it. Go on, I love making that film. I can't believe it.
I know.
That was an odd one. That was an odd one to publicise as well. You were very helpful. You liked it so much. But
I enjoyed the heck out of it.
Want to say to people, it's incredibly enjoyable rubbish. But you can't. you can't say that. But
it is incredibly enjoyable rubbish. I mean, there is not enjoyable rubbish, and then there is really good. I mean, people talk all the time about popcorn movies, and most of the time it means shit. But, you know, a really good, proper, you know, he's built the hotel.
Let me pivot slightly here off the back of that into something that, for fun, that I think you get wrong. So you get so much right about, you know,
so
much I am led by you when I choose films.
Yeah, well, that's
you
a
know,
bad
all
thing.
The time. No, most of the time it's right. Sometimes you disagree completely.
So go on.
This thing you've got that you, what? Not you go on about, but this notion that the lack of a window, day and date releases of films is not harming cinema.
Oh, I see. Right.
It is killing cinema. It's crippling it. Like, you know, people who make smaller films, there's just no way. No one's buying a ticket. No one's going out. And part of who's not going out is they go, and any film I'm in, they go, "Well, when's it on streaming? When will I see it on Netflix?" And only if there were, I, by the way, I might be being a Luddite here because it's never going backwards anyway, so what's the point? But only when you know you've got to wait a long time is there an incentive to leave your house and go out and buy a ticket. Spider-Man, obviously, and James Bond. But
it's not just, Spider-Man and James Bond. I know, I mean, for example, I mean, I suppose the big one is when Ben Wheatley's Field in England opened simultaneously in cinemas, on pay-per-view, on television with adverts, and then on the Monday on Blu-ray. And they did exactly the same business in cinemas as they had expected to do. And, you know, in the case of Mass, as far as I understand, there it's available in some cinemas and it's available on Sky Movies. And it's not that everyone will go see it. Some people will go and see it in cinemas. My experience of this is that I know enough people who go to see... Firstly, you're right. It's like old man shouts at clouds. This is what's happening, Jason. Get with the program.
By the way, thank God for Sky Cinema. They bought a couple of films I've been in. They bought Hotel Mumbai as well. And they, you know, they recognize films, you know, powerful films and controversial stories and things that resonate with adults.
But the key
and God
thing
bless
is,
them for buying them.
The key thing is I don't buy this It's Killing Cinema thing. Because if people... It is not true that people given the choice to see something at home and see it in cinema will simply pick at home. There are enough. I mean, obviously, look, I live in a rarefied, you know, I'm a film critic. My wife is a professor of film. Child two is currently studying film. Child one is
currently
making...
child two says she wants to direct horror films.
Well, then.
Which I'm amazed by. And I said, if I know some people, if my professional experience and social life is useful at any time in your life, it's I know some people that are right up that alley.
Well, here's the thing I've always said about horror films, and I'll stand by it, is the nastiest horror films I've ever seen are made by the nicest people I've ever met. And I have met people who have made...
Well, no, I went to Wes Craven's barbecue. What a lovely fella he was.
No, exactly. And yet I have seen...
I didn't recognise the bones we were eating, but there you go.
I have interviewed somebody who was the head of a very big studio that make lovely children's films that all children love, and he was an absolute wanker. You know, it's you know, so the whole thing about horror filmmakers are great. They are like, you know, really, really nice people. And you should be very proud, Jason, if you've raised somebody.
I know, I'm utterly thrilled. And she's seen everything. And The Exorcist is one of her favorites. And, you know, she's heavily influenced by me. The Babadook is one of her favorites, too.
Which is great.
She was very unimpressed by... I tell you what happened a couple of years ago. It was Halloween. She was staying in with a mate. And she said, "Dad, what can we watch that's really scary?" And I said, "Well, why don't you watch Halloween? It's Halloween." I mean, you know, there's nothing better than the original Halloween. And so they were, I went in the kitchen, I shut the doors to where the front room, they're watching telly, and I switched the lights off so it's dark. And Halloween's, and 20 minutes later, she opens the door and she goes, "It's rubbish, Dad. There's hardly been anyone killed. They killed some people and now I'm waiting 20 minutes. It's not even, is there anything scarier?" And I went, okay. And I put the Babadook on and I shut the doors again. I switched the lights off and I saw the lights come on. Under the door, and I'm like, oh, they're not even concentrating on this. They're kids, they've got no attention span. And I couldn't hear it, which is annoying because obviously, as you know, sound is, you know, an enormous part of a film experience. And I opened the door and it was on very, very quietly. I said, "Is this thing not working for you?" They went, "No, we were terrified. We had to put the lights on and turn the sound down." And I watched, I'm here in Toronto with this lovely cast of people who have not seen many horror films. And we went away for the weekend to a big country house, because that's what people do in Toronto. They've got these lakes with, so we all rented a house. And I put Host on
very
the telly,
good,
which I absolutely
very
adored.
Good.
And we watched it in the dark and nobody could go to sleep. And the lead actress, Sophia Bush here, is terrified every night still, 3 months later in a house, sleeps all the lights on because of Host. So I love a good horror film. But this, I've been steered by you.
Romola Garry's just made a new film. She directed this film called Amulet, which I really liked. It's kind of really creepy. It's a very creepy horror
film. I've seen it.
But
it's very, very good.
Have you seen it? Now, did you like it?
I did. Oh, well, she's very smart. I remember reading
it. No, she's very smart.
Years
and
ago
and
thinking,
a huge horror film fan. A huge horror film fan.
Yeah, yeah.
She came to the show and she was like, you know, she's seen everything. Very early on, she said, "Oh, well, I'm very influenced by Zuofsky's Possession." It was like, okay, that's it. Well, then you're the real deal because you know what you're talking about.
I think that... I mean, awards. Sorry, back to awards again. Yeah. Slightly, horror films are, for some odd reason, because I don't know, they're thought of as genre. The extraordinary acting you get in horror films. I mean, you know, okay, in Mass, we're very upset, we're crying a lot, we're angry a lot. So, in horror films, without the real gravitas of the emotional situations we had to imagine, actors and actresses have to get themselves to a pitch of emotion and stay there for months and months.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That
yeah.
is incredibly, just as a piece of craft, incredibly yeah. difficult to do. And they're always overlooked. Always. Yeah. They never yeah. get any credit for it. And in order to make someone jump or stay in a state of kind of heightened peril, it requires incredible skill. And they're never given their due. I don't think. I remember Under the Shadow was, which I was rather thrilled by, the Biffers.
Yeah,
Under
which
the
is
Shadow,
fantastic. Babak Ambery's film, film. Brilliant.
Yeah, yeah, wonderful filmmaker.
Yeah, no, I love that movie. Absolutely brilliant movie. And again, that was another case of I knew nothing about it. I saw it, and 5 minutes in, you just think this is really, really smart.
Well, that's
and
the best way.
I mean, Babadook,
you know, there's a problem, inherent problem in what you do for a living and what I do, which is really people should just go and see it, buy a subscription. Go and see films and not have a clue what's
yeah,
in it.
Yeah.
Just wait
yeah.
for that. And then afterwards, listen to you. Afterwards, listen to commentators. Afterwards, look at analysis for an interesting discussion. You know, I looked at Censor. I watched Censor. And then I saw what you said about it. And I know other people said yeah. about it. You know, so it's so our era, Censor, though. I do think that you
no,
were looking
it
at it through
it,
the bias
it,
of that. That was when you and I were watching
yeah,
films.
No,
the clothes,
absolutely,
the music, the sweets.
Absolutely everything. Is. And that's what... When you talk about, you know, going skateboarding down the South Bank, and that's like, it's the late 70s, and then you hit the 80s, video arrives, no one can quite believe it. What, you can take a film home? Yes, not just that you can take a film home, you can take Cannibal Holocaust home. You're going, what? You've gone from like nothing to everything. Suddenly the sweet shop is open, and all these films you'd only ever heard of are suddenly available, and there's this brief period before the Video Recordings Act, in which there's nothing is on, you know, nothing
no.
is unavailable.
I'll tell you what has changed as well, that I've not heard you reference, but I think you do it instinctively, which is, there was a period of time that, you know, Robert McKee talks about, but without acknowledging the time change too, where a film, if you made a movie, you had about 20 minutes to grab people's attention.
Mm-hmm.
You'd bought a ticket, you'd sat down in the dark, you certainly weren't going to walk out, you'd
yep.
chosen it, you know, so you can create a world and then something can happen, what, you know, what film scholars call the inciting incident or whatever. Now, it's mostly the case that people are going to be watching it at home eventually anyway or simultaneously. And you don't have 20 minutes. That's just not the way you can tell a story because someone's going to look at their phone or iPad or switch over or look at the guide or, you know, it's just, you don't. So the narrative has changed. It's Dickensian, you know, like when the first chapter came out in the newspaper, he had to hook people so that they bought the next chapter, next installment. And so story structure has changed a lot, I think. And the need to grab people's attention with the story has changed a lot. Although that's why it's so much similar to similar to television.
But when it comes to horror cinema, I remember David Cronenberg saying that, you know, that quite often what you do is you front load the worst stuff at the beginning, because you need to give some, you need to go look bang, and then they're on edge for the rest of it because they don't know whether you're going to do that again. And I always it was a really lovely thing that you show them how far you're going to go, and then it's like they spend the whole of the rest of the movie thinking, is he going to go back there?
I can't remember if I asked you this before. Did you? Is vaguely related in Promising Young Woman.
Yes.
Where Kerry goes out and has that first encounter with whatever his name is, the actor whose name, I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name.
You know exactly what you mean, yep.
Him. And him. Then you cut to her with blood dripping down her, and then you pull back and you go, oh no, it's a hot dog.
Yeah.
And then she goes home and she opens her diary with all the people she's done this to, and she writes his name in blue. And there are some entries in red. And I thought to myself at that point, I know I'm not the only person because I've taken a straw poll. Ooh, some of them didn't get off that lightly.
Yeah, yeah.
She killed some of them.
Yeah.
In which case, you then start asking yourself throughout the film, well, she's not, these people who've done far more egregious things, she's not killing. She's letting them off the hook. She lets the lawyer off the hook. So, and then you go, maybe I was wrong. Oh, no, I've been walking around for an hour or sitting here for an hour thinking she kills people. She doesn't kill people. It's not what she does. I found literally a smaller detail as red biro and blue biro threw me in that film, which is otherwise has many, many fabulous merits. Did you fall for that? Did that?
I saw the red biro, blue biro, and I thought exactly the same as you did, which was I thought red biro. Yeah, that's what I thought that meant. Yeah, because there's no other reason for changing between.
But then what? But then she doesn't do anything violent.
I know because well, it's either yes. By the time we got to, I'd kind of forgotten about it. I'd forgotten about it until you, but I do remember watching it. And I do remember thinking, "Oh yeah, it's the diary entry thing." But
I had to watch it again without that in my head because it ruined it for me the first time. I thought, okay. Well, I don't understand why she's not killing these people. It's such a tiny detail on a film. Which you watch films. Here's the other thing I want to know about you, because I don't get to talk to you enough. Sorry.
This podcast I'm having has gone on forever.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure it'll be cut. I think they want me on set. I think they're rolling cameras. But how is it when I'm listening to you on your shows or your podcast, and you go, well, I've seen that three times. What? Mm. You're watching 12 films a week.
No,
you've got a wife and kids. And you sit there and you go, I'll tell you what I do. Let's put that on again.
It doesn't work like that. So, for example, if say I watch a film I go to a screening of a film and I really like it, and I think, okay, well, I might well lead on that in The Observer. So I'll always watch the lead film at least twice. The second time round to kind of, you know, just because if you're going to write 700 words about a film, you should probably have seen it twice. You know, it's your thing. And then if I enjoy it after having written the thing, I then will watch it again for fun.
That would be a good answer, except for the fact that sometimes films you don't enjoy. You go, I didn't like it the first two times.
Yeah,
but then I watched it again.
But then that's often because if I watch something, and this is my job. So it's like, it's not, you know, so if I watch something and it troubles me and I think, why didn't, you know, why? Because there was one film particularly just recently that I really didn't like. And I watched it. This was not Last Christmas. What's it called? Silent Night. And I really didn't like it. I really didn't like it. But I really didn't like it in a way that bothered me. And I thought, why do I really not like it? Because there are so many things in there that I actually should like. And I went back and I saw it again. And the second time round, I realized that the reason I didn't like it was I didn't believe in any of it.
Right. I heard you say that, and that made perfect sense to me.
But I was really glad that I went back and said, because otherwise it would just be me going, I hate that thing about going, I don't like this film and I don't know why. And incidentally, I think it's entirely possible that the filmmaker may make something really interesting later on, because there is an idea in there. It's just I couldn't figure out why it was leaving me so cold.
Sure. I mean, I feel sorry for those people that made dystopian apocalyptic stories and put them into motion and started developing them before the pandemic. And then there was a year ago and you go, I don't need to, I really don't need any help from fiction to imagine the world as I know it falling apart and us all eating each other in the street. So please don't serve up any more of those stories. I find them very tricky, you know.
Well, listen, we should probably draw this to a close because you're called on set and I've probably got
to go. I do have to go to set. Yeah, only because I wasn't meant to be, but we got snowed out and now there's a bunch of scenes they're trying to cram in.
Yeah. Mass is available now in some cinemas and on Sky Cinema. I would advise anybody to see it. As Jason has said, it is, I think, you know, it's a shame that Shawshank had it, because you should have used Hope Can Set You Free, because it is a great line.
That's true.
But it is, you know, it is an uplifting spiritual experience, and it's one of the most remarkable films I've seen for a long time, and I absolutely love it. It's the first, and I've now gone back, and I know that that's what I think about.
Can we put this in context? You know, when you go to a restaurant and you go, "What's good?" And they go, "Oh, the ribs are fantastic, and the avocados to die for." And I always go, "What's crap then?" Because you might just like kind of just put in context. Mark is my friend from a long time ago. He is very, very happy to completely eviscerate the really shitty films I've been in many
you
times.
You have been in some shit. You know,
I've been in some appalling films, and I give you full license to say so.
The most appalling one was that fucking science fiction film that I sat through for 2 3/4 hours because you were in it, and then you weren't even fucking in it.
I wasn't
you were just
in it. I did a voiceover
some...
in my bedroom.
Terrible Sorry. Alien doing some what the fuck was that
by the
about?
Way huge hit in Australia,
was it?
Huge hit, they loved it. Yeah, there you go.
What was it called?
You need to watch it 3 times to fully appreciate
it. I know why
to...
I didn't like it. What was it called?
It's called Occupation Rainfall.
Occupation Rainfall. It was the sequel to another film that I'd never seen.
Yes, that's
and
right.
I have to
Me
say
neither.
I'm not going to go back and watch it anyway.
Okay, fair enough. Watch Mass again. Anyway, it's really lovely to see you.
See you, well, hope to see you in the flesh at some point when, you know, too. Whenever that's actually possible.
Stay safe, everybody, and go to the cinema. Have 3 vaccinations and go to the cinema. See this and anything else you can.
All right, lots of love.
I've got to go.
Take care.
Bye.
There we are. That's the great Jason Isaacs talking about Mass and pretty much everything else. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. I know it's a rather long one, but there you go. You don't have short conversations with Jason. If you have enjoyed it, remember to subscribe, tell your friends, visit our Patreon page. I'll be back soon doing something else which will be shorter than the one that we've just done. Thanks very much for listening. Subscribe, tell your friends, stay safe, keep watching this, guys.